So the first question that I had was the, tell me the story of how you came to be a teacher. So what I was going to do was just kind of start from the beginning of how it was for me, and then...
Okay.
Yeah. So...
Yeah, it sounds good. I mean, you know a lot about that, and for me as well, because we were there together when we became teachers, ironically.
That's something that people should realize is that we both started teaching at the very same time, in very different circumstances. So, I mean,
that's
I
true.
Can talk to my circumstances, because I started teaching at the Callan School of English in Spain, in Valencia, and I think I had it was really lucky. I had a really good deal because I got a considerable amount of training to begin with, and before we came, we just did that short like weekend course. It was kind of, in my mind, teaching wasn't the plan. It was more of a backup. But once I started doing it, I started to actually really enjoy it. The Callan School of English, why I say it's very different to your experiences was with Callan School of English, as you found out, that it's a direct teaching method. So they have their own kind of style of doing things where it's people refer to it as kind of parroting, but I think there was a lot more of an art to it where you're asking these questions, and if they can't give you the stock answer or give you an answer, you make them follow the answer from the book. And a lot of people had the mentality that was it, but I think once you kind of become, I started to move away from that, and I would give them the stock questions, but I'd kind of add my own twist to them and, kind of keep them on their toes. So that was where I first started. And I thought that was, if I was to start teaching again, I would start teaching with that, because it got me, it was a crutch in a way, because everything was done for me. I just had to kind of perform. So it was a lot easier for me because I didn't have to think about lesson plans as much or kind of a whole bunch of stuff that I realized going forward, especially after doing the CELTA, which I'll get into later, was so much more. It was kind of a stripped down version of teaching in a way.
I mean, I think you made a few interesting points there. I think let's say the majority of I don't even know if it's the majority of them, but let's say a lot of English language teachers might sort of stick their nose up at the direct method, it's from the early 1970s and it's speak and repeat and all this kind of stuff. But what I know about it, I mean, first of all, when I was first learning Spanish, I did a lot of learning audio linguistically, Pimsleur and those kind of stuff. But that's not a far cry away from the direct method. A lot of it is, translate this sentence into Spanish, and then you listen, and then you copy the pronunciation of how it's being said by the native, right? So, I mean, it's got elements of the direct method in there. And that really gave me a good base for my Spanish, Without that springboard, that 6 months of audio linguistic training, I think I would have really struggled with the Spanish when we got to Spain. But that was just enough of a start to really get me going with it. And I owe a lot to that. And, I've met, I met some of your students from Callan in Valencia, and they only had good things to say about the Callan method. Like, for them, it was the one place where they knew exactly what they were going to get. If they went to some other school, they might get a good teacher, but they might also get someone who's sitting on their hands and, just kind of talking to them. Which is, it can be a viable method when it's done right, but it can also be a way of slacking off, can't it? It can also be a way of just getting to the front of a class and being the entertainer teacher who doesn't actually teach anything, right? So I think there's definitely things to be taken from it. It's definitely effective. And this idea that it's something that you pretty much have these lessons in your head, so you can kind of fall back to it. It's one of those things that if you were doing like a, let's say a standard CELTA class, you know, a sort of what do you call it, presentation practice production type thing, right? A PPP standard CELTA, which is actually, I think, is a lot more complex than sometimes, because people turn their nose up at PPP these days as well. And it's like, hang on a minute.
I know what you mean by that. Yeah.
As well, there's many different ways of doing it, isn't there? It doesn't have to be like today we're doing the present perfect. Oh, you know, you can do it other ways. But anyway, let's say you're doing a lesson like that and you've got 10 minutes at the end. Someone who's been trained as a Callan teacher can throw in 10 minutes of direct method at the end, just like that, right?
Yeah.
With
the direct method as well, though, I agree when you talk about learning Spanish, it's great for beginners. If you know absolutely zero English and you want to get a good base really fast, it's absolutely fantastic. I wish there was something out there for all the other different languages that I've tried to learn. Once you kind of get past when you're starting to touch intermediate, then you kind of need to inject your own personality into it in a way. But touching back on learning Spanish, one of the other ones that we did Pilmsner and Michelle Thomas. Michelle Thomas is one of the people that I have learned a lot from as a teacher, and I applied a lot of what he was doing, because he wasn't quite Pilmsner. He was doing repetition, but he was also kind of like mnemonics. There was like lots of, he got you about it in different ways. And I would kind of change and go away from the direct method and kind of add that sort of stuff in there, where, you know, because I've already got in my head the previous lessons that I've known these students have been practicing in the Callan book. So I can throw in the different vocabulary and throw in different questions that aren't on the book, but I'm fairly confident that they'll be able to answer it because I know that they know the answer. So it's just me kind of like poking the answer out of them.
Michelle Thomas was definitely an interesting one. I mean, at the end of the day, he was a guy who had Hollywood celebrities paying him, you know, thousands of dollars an hour for a class. So there's a reason for that. Like you say, he used a lot of mnemonics. Now, I do think mnemonics are great. They do have their limitations. They require a lot of creativity to create them. I like them. I use them. But sometimes, you know, if you sit down, sometimes you just don't feel creative. And you try and come up with some mnemonics for something, and it's just not working, you know. So
it's just another tool in the toolbox.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, but you know, the other thing he focused a lot on was this idea of the students being very relaxed, right? Remember, he had that as like a thing, and I remember quite liking that at the time and thinking that's got to be a thing, right? And later, when I went on and did the diploma, I learned it was part of a huge method in the 1970s again called Suggestopedia, which is a really bizarre name for a teaching method, but that's what it's called, and it was. Suggestopedia is actually quite descriptive about how relaxation is achieved. So, you know, you have the students in armchairs and you have plants. You have to have plants and you play Baroque music in the background, specifically Baroque music, which is a bit...
This sounds familiar. Did they touch on that in CELTA or something?
They probably touch on all of the 1970s method, because there's three big ones in the 1970s that kind of came together and became communicative language teaching, right, from the 1990s onwards, which was Suggestopedia. And then there was one called community language teaching, which is like you put the students in a circle, just let them have a conversation, and the teacher just kind of hops around in the background and occasionally like throws in some new vocabulary or throws in another discussion question or whatever, just basically keeps the conversation. Yeah, they call the teacher, it's the idea of the teacher as a facilitator or whatever. Mm-hmm. Suggestopedia was one of them, so maybe you've come across it in the CELTA. And it's that, like you say, it's that idea of relaxation. And I do think it's a big thing, because it's a thing that can be, I don't think it's something that, you know, can magically help you learn quicker. But what it is it's something that reduces the possibility of or eliminates the chance that a student is going to develop with these sort of like stress-based hang-ups about language learning, which can be a big problem. And, you know...
A huge point that I think gets missed a lot with the teaching. But not a lot. It doesn't get missed, but it's not something that people are conscious of per se. For example, you know, when I teach IELTS, I try to make the classroom and make it so this is kind of how it's going to be in the IELTS exam. So they're used to it. You know, like they're accustomed, because you kind of feel a bit rigid, you're feeling a bit uncomfortable. Well, there's this whole idea with learning and with with memory, is that memory is partly based on emotions. So if you are feeling happy, you remember more happy stuff. You feel sad, you remember more sad. That sort of thing. So
that's right.
For me, it makes sense that if you're relaxed, that's when you're relaxed, when you're having conversations, that's how you want to be when you're learning. Yeah. If you're stressed, you know, you're going to be only able to talk in a different language if you're stressed. Imagine that.
Yeah. And the amount of people I come across, students who've been studying for a long time, and you can see they've got these hang-ups. They start getting themselves more stressed when they're trying to produce stuff. And you know that's got to come from stuff in their past. You know, it's got to come from teachers putting pressure on them, or they were talking to English speakers who just shut off, you know, because they were taking too long. You know, negative experiences. You know, and I certainly had some of these as a language learner, and I know that you had some of these learning Spanish, right? Because for a time you kind of like it almost like pushed it away, right? Because it just became such a negative experience to keep diving into it. And that's why one of the things that I really focus on these days in my teaching is this idea of sustainability and the idea of, you know, you always want to be doing sustainable activities. It's not about hitting your head against the wall as hard as you can over and over again until you finally learn the language. It's about finding things that you actually enjoy doing and then just let it build up. You know, let those things build up. Okay, you know, because one of the things I really enjoyed in Spain was the intercambio de idiomas, right? The little language exchanges. I loved it. It was great fun. Yeah. And, you know, as a result, I kept doing it, meeting new people. Some of them were crazy. Some of them were all right. You know, it was fun. And, you know, back in the day, I used to think that the genius of intercambio de idiomas was the fact that I was like writing it down and then they'd write down my mistakes and then we'd kind of teach each other. But you know what? I don't think it was. Yeah. I think the genius part of it was the fact that I enjoyed it. So I kept doing it.
Yeah.
And I did it week after week after week. And I did it because I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I think there's not enough talked about on learning, on leading with emotions with learning. It has to be something that you engage with, that you enjoy. And if you are not making progress, then you've got to find an element of that language where you can, or whatever you do in your life that you enjoy, that you can kind of integrate with that language.
Yeah, I agree. That kind of goes to that. I think I mentioned it to you. There's this fella, what was his name? I think his name's Mark Almond. And he wrote something called Putting the Human into Teaching. And it's the idea that teacher trainers focus too much on what to do and less on how to be.
Yeah.
So we teach teachers techniques and say, well, this is the best technique you can use, right? Start off with a grass skirts activity and a board rush and whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't focus on, well, you know, go into the classroom with a big smile on your face, get relaxed in your seat, chat with the students for 5 minutes and then see where the conversation goes and work with that. The idea, if someone comes in and they're quite charismatic and they do something like that, you know, like traditional methodology or certainly CELTA methodology, you might tell us, oh, we just come in and done a load of TTT and not achieved anything. But if we look at it in a kind of a different lens, we can say, well, we've come in, got the students relaxed, established a topic with a bit of general conversation without saying today's topic is going to be stories in the past. You know, instead you've just come in, you've said, oh, hey, Maria, what did you do last weekend? oh yeah, you know, and just kind of got the students relaxed and started a conversation that way. Yeah. And then that's, I think that links to what you're saying about bringing the emotion into how we teach.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. And it's, there's a lot of rigidity and not allowing that you to be a person. You've got to be, I guess in the past, you had to be a teacher, so you had to be the authority. And, you know, especially when you're teaching younger kids, there are limits to that because you cannot be you cannot be a peer. When you're teaching adults, you can. But I think it's for me, it's another part of the school.
I think I used to push it quite to its limit, to be honest, but I think you are right. I remember that. Like sometimes when I was teaching the 9 and 10 year olds last year in Vietnam, I definitely think there was moments where I was more childish than the kids. In fact, I know there was because they used to tell me off. I'd be like just being stupid and doing something. Literally, I had like a 9 year old girl going, "Teacher Rich, blah, blah, blah." Just like, oops. Sorry, miss.
That's not to say it's necessarily a bad thing. It becomes, you know, when you teach different situations, you kind of have to give yourself a little bit of breathing room because you're kind of finding what works, what doesn't. You know, you'll probably learn from that little girl, and you probably have flashbacks to her. maybe I shouldn't do that again. That sort of thing, but you know, it doesn't.
But. Well, yeah, no, to be honest, quite the opposite. I think I was telling the story in sort of a funny way. The reality is, I think, Neil, it comes down to, you know, a lot of the thing with kids, behavior management, classroom management, and all that kind of stuff, it's really a complex issue of experience. And as I'm sure you know, the more experience you get with kids, like you get eventually become massively comfortable because you get to a point where you know you've got the rod if you need it. You know what I mean? Like, and they know, right?
Yeah.
They know that you have power to do stuff because, you know, you've hinted at it before. And once they know and you know, it's like you can kind of let it all go then.
Yeah, because the hierarchy has been established. It's that's kind of what I refer to as you can't be a peer so much.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. You can't.
Going away from the sort of Callan and direct method stuff that I was doing in Spain that got me started, kind of got me comfortable being in a classroom and doing this kind of conversational style towards the end. It was more conversational. And doing these intercambios as well, I learned a lot from doing them as a teacher, even though I wasn't necessarily teaching.
I think just learning a language is something that any language teacher should go through process of, really.
Everyone should learn a language or learn to learn what it's like to learn a language, at least.
Yeah.
But then I moved to Canada after like 3 years or two, 3 years, something like that.
It's about 3 years. It's about 3, wasn't it?
And in Canada, they had the provision if you want it, you actually have to have, if you want to teach English as a second language, foreign language, you actually have to have credentials. So more than just, you know, like a weekend certificate. So I got the CELTA and then I started teaching at a school there. And I was just doing the general ESL classroom teaching and fast transitioned into doing IELTS. It was more British based, so for that the school it made sense that they had someone that was British that was teaching that.
That must have been really different from what you were doing before.
It was
the fact that you were just thrown into all this exam.
It was kind of like on different ends of the spectrum in respect.
Yeah, I imagine.
It was really, really challenging, and I spent, well, you know, the CELTA is an intense course. Not as intense as doing something like the Delta, I know, but just...
It is at the time, yeah.
But teaching without having to do all the prep, which was basically what I was doing in Spain, with the direct method, and then that being added on, thinking how can I structure this, how to do the class the best way, and trying to apply what I did from CELTA. That took up so much time. It takes so much time. It's kind of the iceberg. You know, the students see the tip of the iceberg, they don't see the what's underneath the ocean, which is all that preparation work and the methodology behind that. But that was fantastic. I mean, I loved the CELTA. I thought it was great. It gave me a good idea of a structure. And it's kind of a structure that I still use to this day, but it's a good grounding.
It is a good grounding. I think I got a lot out of it. Some of the things, it's definitely not beyond criticism, but then it's all these, you don't want to criticize these things too much, because ultimately there is so I think some people really break it apart, especially at diploma level, you get people who start being like, the CELTA, completely teaches people the wrong stuff, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, it's easy enough to say that now after you've done the CELTA and you've been teaching for 8 years and you're now doing the diploma and learning all this advanced stuff to be like, well, the CELTA should do more task-based learning, whatever. And maybe it should, but maybe it does now, who knows, this has probably changed quite a bit, right? But I think at the end of the day, one of the main things the CELTA establishes is it gets you thinking about why you do the things you do a little bit, which you expand on later in the dip, right? So in the CELTA, because one of the big things, one of the biggest pain in the arses when you're doing the CELTA is this idea you have to write a rationale for all the shit you're doing, because at that stage you've got no idea what a rationale is, right? So you're like, okay, I'm going to start the class with I'll get the students up and do a board rush on winter vocabulary, right? And then you've suddenly got this guy who's been training teachers for the last 20 years, and he's like, why? Don't know, because it'll be a laugh. Yeah, but how does that help your lesson goals? Because it's a game and that makes people more communicative.
I could rationalize everything.
Yeah, that's it. And eventually, you do start to think about it, or if you don't think about it, you at least say, I haven't got a clue. And then they tell you, you learn about this pre-activation of schematic knowledge or whatever, right?
The idea of you kind of walking into the classroom, you don't know what the student, well, you should have an idea of what the student's levels should be, but often is the case that you've probably experienced in your teaching career that that's not always the way it is.
Well, do you know, in the dip where I did it in Oxford House, Barcelona, good place with very good teacher trainers, right? They deliberately, for our class, they deliberately put people in there who were level tested at A2 and level tested at B2. They had that whole range, and it was deliberate because they, for one, they wanted to kind of push us and test us, but also it gives you a reason, an excuse, and a need to differentiate, as in you've got to be able to teach a class to this huge range of levels, right, that still works. So you've got to have hard materials, easy materials, fast finishes stuff, and it was quite good actually, because it's not a standard thing that they do with diplomas. Some places do it, some places don't. But I found it really useful because, as you say, in the real world,
think that all the students are all at the same level, so they just plan without any kind of students in mind, without any flexibility to where they're going to approach stuff. So for me, that framework, the PPP framework, was just the first P, the presentation, is just kind of, you need to go into a classroom and understand what the level is there. So are you going to be doing some eliciting? Are you going to be, trying to see, who knows what?
Yeah.
Who's got a little bit? Or even just personalities, is this person who's going to be the most vocal? Who's going to be shy? That sort of thing. Just kind of feeling things out. And then how are you going to get this language across? Are you going to be able to retrieve it from the students and then kind of put it on the board, or are you going to be giving it to them, or that sort of idea? And then, you know, the whole practice and production, for me, it just made sense. You know, you first have to, make sure that they have the language before you can do something with it. And obviously, because they've just got it, they're not going to be very good at it. So they kind of need someone to watch them and make sure that they're not, when they're doing activities, that they're not going too wildly off course or what have you. And then just kind of giving them the reins in that production aspect and going, okay, just go for it. Just use it. Use it as much as you can.
Yeah.
That framework was fantastic. That was the main thing I got away from the CELTA, plus, all the timing. Yeah. But then it was kind of just, okay, I have an idea of how a classroom should be now. And that was my main takeaway from that. And then taking that into an actual classroom with the general ESL and IELTS, it was just, what's your goal for the day? And then kind of planning backwards of how you're going to get there.
Yeah, and I mean, did you find that, because it must have been an interesting one as well, because you've come from the direct method, and then you do your CELTA, and obviously in the CELTA, I imagine they use some pretty nice material, like maybe English file or something they were using for your CELTA, I don't know. For my CELTA, they were... Headway has its pros and cons, but it's a good one. Mm-hmm. I know some people love it. You got some like interactive community of language based material, and then when you were doing the IELTS, you probably found the material was a bit more dry, I would imagine.
With the IELTS,
I'm just guessing. Maybe it wasn't.
I wouldn't say dry. With the Headway, and a lot of the materials like English file Headway, I kind of do find it a bit dry. You have to sprinkle a bit of personality in there anyway.
Oh yeah, but I think you always
with
do.
With the IELTS stuff, it's just okay. People now in Headway and English file and all those the standard general ESL course books. People are like, this person's having a conversation on the telephone or they're talking about their favorite prop, and then when you go to IELTS it's like, okay, so this is the difference between nuclear fusion and nuclear fission, and this is the process on how that works within a diagram.
That must be specifically for the higher levels, no? Level 9 and level 10 or whatever it is in IELTS, the higher ones.
Well, when I started with the general, with the IELTS, I was teaching beginners.
So they were
aiming for level 5, band 5 and
yeah.
6.
But, yeah, okay.
You know, they're still going to encounter that language.
Right, because the exam's the same.
Yeah, because the exam's the same. So it was kind of me kind of trying to strip it down a little bit to make it a little bit more understandable and, giving them techniques and tips on, well, okay, so maybe you don't understand this, but kind of what can you extrapolate from the things that you do understand, and how can you make it so if you put something, you're more likely to get more likely to get the answer than not. Because
did you ever do any IELTS examining?
I've never done any IELTS, official IELTS examining.
Have you worked with colleagues who have been examiners?
Yeah.
So you've had conversations with them about it, I guess, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's things that they look out for. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I never did it with IELTS, but back in Spain, towards the end, I was doing Cambridge English examining. And it does really give you a lot of insights, being an examiner, obviously. It shouldn't really, but it does, because we're humans, we're not machines. And I think, actually, that's one of the biggest things I learned. We're humans, not machines,
Yeah.
because I remember one time, and definitely not going to name any names, not going to give any kind of context whatsoever, but I was getting assessed actually by the top man. So this is what happens as a Cambridge English examiner. Anyway, there's always two examiners. There's an interlocutor, the one who speaks. There's the quiet one who grades, and you swap over every pair of candidates. And then we also had the big man in who was watching me. And I was the interlocutor, so I was doing the speaking. You know, in this part of the test, you'll have two pictures. I want you to talk about the pictures and compare them, or whatever the bollocks, you know, whatever script thing you're saying. And this girl came in, and this was, it was supposed to be B1, you know. And she kind of said a few things about the pictures, and then she just kind of like flicked the paper away, and she was like, "What more can I say about this?" You know, and she just said it in this kind of way that was like, "What a load of rubbish this is," you know what I mean? And that killed her. Like, it really killed her, because her English was sounded okay. Not great, but it seemed like she was all right at the level, right? But as soon as she said that, I mean, I was obviously like, what the, you know?
Yeah.
You're going to like be like that about the material, for God's sake? Like, what are we supposed to do about that? And of course I knew, and you know, when I give my grades, you know, and I was getting assessed on them because they have to be within a certain band of the guy who's watching you. Otherwise you fail and need extra training, right?
Yeah.
So I knew I had to be within the right band, but I kind of knew what I was going to do anyway, right? I was going to just fail her, which is where she'd put herself. And that's, you know, I did it and I put it exactly the same as the guy watching. And he really slagged her off. You know, he was just like, who's going to come into an exam, blah, 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 blah. And you could see he'd been a bit offended by it. And I think anyone who's an oral examiner will attach a little bit to the materials, you know.
Yeah.
So if you come in with a negative attitude, and it's going to apply to everything. If you just come in and just seem like, you know, you're not being pleasant, you're not being polite. But if you come in and you're pleasant and polite, you know, yeah, it's not going to make the difference between a huge fail and a pass. But it might, well, in fact, I know it will, even though it shouldn't, it will make the difference between a borderline fail and a pass. It will.
Yeah.
If you get the really pleasant person who comes in and goes, hello, how are you doing? Okay. But not someone who's like trying to butter you up. You know, that's the other thing. Cause you get the guys who come in, you know, I got this guy once who come in, he immediately tried to shake my hand. Pleasure to meet you or whatever. Both of us were like, the examiners just sitting there looking at, you know, it's like, okay, sit down. You know, that's too much, but thank you. It didn't count against him, you know, but also it was a bit like, all right. Yeah. Yeah. But just be pleasant, you know, just be pleasant, just be polite. That stuff does help. Excuse me.
So from the Canada and the CELTA and the IELTS, I went to Korea. I taught in a Hogwon, a training center that dealt with from like basically pre-K, K-1 to high school. Mostly just kind of the upper level of middle school, and that was just general, the general English, and then some specialty classes. Like I did some debate classes as well with the students that were really good, that kind of just, you know, a general ESL class is not going to cut it anymore. They need something a little bit more geared to, you know, just practicing conversation, but it still needs to have a structure, so they end up doing the debate. And with Korea, I worked so hard. It was a grind. And it works because that was when I learned how to prep and just strip down everything that you needed in the lesson plan. Without any fluff, because you just didn't have time to kind of think, well, what would be a better class, a better activity to do with here, or I want to try this activity, but it means that I've got to prep a little bit more.
Do you mean you were teaching so many classes that you didn't have time to do like extensive prep? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you basically had seven classes a day.
I've heard that. Least, yeah.
And then, and
it's like production line. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. 15-minute break between them. Go.
Jeez.
Yeah. That was. They got their money's worth. And
yeah,
I'm not going to complain about that because it was a business and I did learn a lot from that. I learned to be more efficient and I learned to streamline, you know, what was important, and to also, you know, think more on my feet and rely less on the plan.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point about efficiency and thinking on your feet, because one of the things I think that post-Celtic teachers find very hard, some of them anyway, is the amount of prep that they seem to need to do, because they don't realize that obviously the more experienced you become, like the less time that you spend, maybe when you start teaching you have to spend an hour a class preparing stuff, but obviously you get better at it. And like you say, thinking on your feet I think is critical. Oh. And experience is irreplaceable when it comes to that as well.
Yeah, because you build up all these activities in your head, you have all this preparation or stuff to refer back to, so if you had some dead time because you didn't have enough time to plan properly, or you know, something didn't work out because you're dealing with kids, having something to fall back on and that experience, it's needed. And I think it's a good way for a lot of people to kind of cut their teeth, but it's trial by fire, definitely. If you start with doing something like that.
Yep. Yeah, sounds like it.
And then, so I did that for like two, three years, and from Korea went to China, and China I was teaching public school and I was teaching primary, elementary school kids.
Wow.
And that was completely different because I'm used to these small 10 student classes in a training center where I've got intimate interaction. I get to know the kids, which was one of the main things that I learned from teaching them, was, you know, establishing what it is that makes them tick and, you know, kind of morphing lessons.
Find a lot about.
Yeah, to then teaching over 50 plus students in a
course. Whoa, 50? How old were these kids? Like seven?
Grade one. I specialized in doing grade one, two, and
so three. So that's 5, 6, right?
Yeah, 5, 6 years old.
Yeah, whoa, okay.
I'm very young, 5, 6 years old as well.
Right, and so tiny, tiny children.
With a lot of kids, then, you know, in the Hog Ones, doing a lot of group activities to being, wow, how can I do all these group activities with these kids? This is their first time touching English.
Did you have a couple of TAs and stuff as well with that?
No.
What? You had no. What? But no TAs?
No.
Well, you were just you and 50 kids.
They would sit in for like the first couple of classes. But I figured out very early on that I was basing a lot of my classes around PowerPoint because it was a way to kind of get them to focus and to narrow their view.
That's what you need to do.
But yeah, a lot of the classes, especially the second year, they would poke their head in. But by that time I was already experienced. I had a plan. I knew how to control kids. It was not perfect by a long shot because kids will be kids. And there's a lot of stuff that I would have liked to have done more.
But you must have had sort of surprise disaster scenarios as well, you know, someone vomiting up, someone punching someone else, someone, you know, wetting themselves. I mean, they're five. I mean, I imagine that happened though. And I mean, dealing with that situation when you've got another 49 kids to take care of, while your attention is divided by, you know, because they sort of, it's almost like they have a sixth sense for when the teacher is occupied with some emergency situation, isn't it?
Yeah, and then
it's really crazy.
But that's when experience comes in. That's when you assign other students to help you or to deal with the situation. And it's like you say, you've got that rod. So it's just, if something goes to shit, you've still got the rod. It's just you have to know what to do with it to, you know, direct the students to help you, because they're not, they're kids. It doesn't mean that they're bad.
Direction. But I think I would feel very uncomfortable in that situation, because you know, a lot of my rod techniques, a lot of my discipline techniques involve me at least knowing the student's name. I've found that it doesn't work as well if I'm just like, hey, you come here kind of thing, you know. But if I know, like, you know, if I'm like, Jose, because, you know, I've said their name, they know, I know their name. Mm-hmm. They know that if I talk to their parents, I know who their parents are because I know their name, right? They know I have all these options. But if it's a class of 50 Chinese kids, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, Ming, you know, or whatever, you know, it could be anything.
Some have English names, some don't have English names. But that's when stuff like nicknames come in. And that's, you know, when they learn the vocabulary and they learn, you know, that someone's tall or short. You can, you know, point to them and do that sort of thing. You can be funny with it, and, you know.
Okay.
Take a
sure.
And that sort of stuff. But it's difficult. I mean, you.
Did you ever record any? I mean, you probably couldn't, I guess, because of child protection. But I would really like to see a recording of someone teaching a class of 50 kids.
If you'd like to see a recording of a person teaching 50 plus students in very well and organized manner, please go to Team Teacher China. I've got multiple videos of me teaching these long classes, different styles of classes, reading classes, your PPP style classes. It's something that I was good at, and that's why I started Team Teacher China, because I would be getting a lot of questions from people of like, well, what are you doing? Is it what PowerPoints are you doing? So I started the channel because there was a lot of these kind of backpack teachers that you know, just because you're a backpack.
So, to be honest, we all start off that way. That's another thing that people turn their noses up about, me included. You know, backpack teachers do it bothers me that people enter our industry and don't take it seriously. But let's be honest, at one time or another, we all started off not being a teacher and then we became one. So.
I mean, when do you ever start a job and you're like super serious about your job, unless you, you know, already put in, you know, like 8 years of medical school, then you're like, I'd better be damn serious about my job.
Yeah, yeah. And then you find out you don't actually like being a doctor. You're in big trouble.
Oh, that's a whole different conversation about...
No, that sounds fascinating, man. That's great that you got the little product placement in there as well. And you know, it was almost like we set that up, wasn't it? But we didn't set that up is the interesting thing. I was genuinely asking, and I was genuinely wondering how do you deal with this classroom of 50 kids? And the fact that you've got obviously I'm exposing the fact that I haven't been through your back catalogue of videos yet, but I hadn't seen any of you like actually actively teaching.
500 videos, so I don't.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
I didn't realise you had that many videos on the channel either. Oh, I think I've got about 30.
Yeah.
After like 8 years.
A lot of people need help.
Oh my god, yeah.
Some of the videos aren't so
good. Maybe I should change the focus of my channel. But hey ho. Yeah.
With the public school as well, it also I can do a whole episode on podcast on just talking about China and the difficulties of dealing with that.
Save that for another time, but yeah.
I mean, right now I'm back in Canada teaching an IELTS again. Mm. And I think I just to finish kind of my teacher narrative story of how I came to be how I am. One of the things when I was thinking about this and thinking about the question, looking back, was how much how much of a variety that I've encountered in the classroom, and how every situation was different. And
yeah,
I think people, one of the things is people end up doing just generally SL for adults or you know, just teaching kids. And I kind of feel lucky in that I've had all these different experiences. Yeah. But I don't think one of the things I appreciate is when we talk about teaching English, it can mean so many different things. You know, my experience is going to be very different to other people's experience. If someone's really good at teaching kids, then, you know, then maybe they wouldn't be very good at teaching adults. They would be able to get there, but I wouldn't disregard what they would have to say. So because it's every situation's different. I don't think people appreciate that enough about teaching English, is that if you are someone that's got a big and kind of varied background, or just even if you're specialized in one thing, the amount of depth and experience and detail that you would have and intricacies that you have with it is, you know, it's mind-boggling.
I think so. I think that's probably why I'm still a teacher after all this time, to be honest. So I've never been particularly good at sticking to one job. You know, I get bored easily. And I think it's what you say, Neil, that it's so complex. There's so many things that you can learn. You never stop learning as a teacher. I don't want to start whipping out these ridiculous platitudes like, it's almost like the kids teach us, you know, or anything gay like that. But that was a bit PC, wasn't it? I shouldn't say stuff like that or whatever. Anyway, I do this on my own channel as well, so it's not really a problem. I agree with you. I think it's so complex. I also agree with you about getting involved in a diversity of different types of classes. You know, it is the more difficult thing to do. And yes, some people just really do not want to teach kids, is the big one, isn't it? And, you know, I was like that. I don't know if it's worth us going through this whole question again for me, or whether I should just throw in bits. What would you like to do? Or is that what we're going to do?
Yeah, I think so. I think it would be worth a whole podcast of, you know, what is Rich's background and that sort of thing. And focus on that.
Okay.
We might even have to do that like next week or something.
Yeah, okay. No, I'm happy to do that. I guess just to finish that point rather than leaving it as a cliffhanger then. The first time I taught kids was quite early on, was after about teaching for about a year or so, and it was before I did my CELTA. It was with an international house who, let's be honest, international house's reputation continues to fall because of the way that they have great training programs, but let's be honest, the way that they maintain the standards of their franchises, in my experience, is not been good. So I worked for IH Valencia. I'm quite happy to name them, as well as IH Cordova. They're two terrible institutions, and I would recommend that everyone stays very clear of them. But working for IH Valencia, I had my first kids class, and that was like you in your situation, it was working at a state school. This was after I'd only been teaching for a year before doing the CELTA. Oh my god, I had no idea what to do. I had 25 kids and they completely just destroyed me. They destroyed the classroom, they destroyed each other, they threw stuff out the window, everything went wrong. None of them spoke a word of English, I didn't speak a word of Spanish. I had no TA, I had no idea what was going on, and it was only an hour, but it was horrendous, and it traumatized me so much. I wasn't particularly good with kids at the time anyway, that I never touched kids again. Oh god, that's a bit of a weird phrase, isn't it? I never touched kids classes again. I never went anywhere near teaching kids again for 5 years. And then when I did, I was very cautious. You know, I went into it like, all right, okay, sure, I'll do a bit of that, you know. But then when I got, and I just did like a few here and there and kind of got to understand a little bit more about teaching kids, I was like, all right. And then when I eventually, you know, later got to Vietnam and I was doing majority of my classes became like kids, actually, teens and kids. You know, and it's just once you learn the ins and outs of it, once you learn the like I say, the behavior management and the child psychology, basically, how child's minds are just so different to ours. It becomes very energizing. You know, it's a completely different thing than teaching adults. Well, almost a completely different thing.
Yeah, and that's kind of the point that I was trying to touch on, that it's different. It's completely I know you say it's not completely different, but
it's very, almost
very different.
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. It's very, very different. And I used to feel very, very different in that class and after those classes, because when I teach kids, I start bouncing off the wall. And I know not all teachers do this. Some people do. Some people stay very calm, you know, as a teacher, and they make the kids calm by being calm. Mm-hmm. I don't. I go in and I start flying around and bouncing off the wall. You know, everything is about, all right, bam, 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 right. Everyone sit down. I've got something to tell you, you know. And I'm like throwing memes up on the interactive whiteboard. Check out this meme. Right. Okay. It's kind of related to what I'm about to tell you. And then I start on something else. Right. And the kids start getting a bit, you know, thingy as well. And then obviously you kind of bring them down a bit when they've got to go back to their tables and do whatever, because you don't want them to go back to the tables, bounce off the wall as well. But yeah. I always come out of those kids' classes like, you know, I was kind of buzzing, you know, didn't really come out of adults' classes with the same energy, right? Well, so that, it was a very different thing.
Saying, well, it's not a saying per se, but when people talk about how they like to be around younger people or how they like to be around kids because it helps them feel young again, then they're taking that energy, and I guess that's kind of what you're doing.
I think for me it was, not so much about energy, but because I actually think the energy came from me to them, or it was almost like I thought they were going to be like that, so I came in like that, and then they would react to my energy and kind of, or whatever. But so I think the psychologically, definitely, I de-aged. Like when I'm around 9 and 10 year olds, I definitely feel like I'm acting a bit like a 9 year old or whatever. Except when one of them, you know. I don't know, when one of them says a naughty word or something, and then you have to get into serious teacher mode and be like, oi, all right, let's have a talk. Why did you say that? You know, it's not a good thing. Do you know what it means? Do we have to speak to your father about this? You know?
Yeah.
Or do you want another word? Do you want to speak to my boss? He's a very busy man, but you know, maybe you'd like to have a chat with him and explain why you're going to waste his time by saying these naughty words in class. But anyway, you know, you get the idea. Psychologically, and that's one of the reasons. Actually, I'd say my favorite age range. You know, I'm getting into my story. Back off. We'll save it for another episode.
It's cool, and you get into it, and that's what I like.
I like it. I like it, obviously.
Yeah. So the next question that I was thinking that we could have is, you know, kind of talking about what it was before teaching and after teaching. So the idea being, well, what were your expectations about being a teacher? And what was that reality after you became the teacher?
That's an interesting one, isn't it?
I liked that question. I saw the question. Like, tell me about the expectations and the realities. And then I thought to myself, well, my expectations was after watching, you know, so many movies like Dead Poets Society and all these, you know,
Kindergarten Cop.
No, that's who is your daddy? That's more.
That's a good point.
But yeah. So for me, like, it was more that these teachers are supposed to kind of inspire, you know, like Dangerous Minds, and then suddenly there's going to be all these changing lives around and stuff like that. Mm. And I think, you know, there are elements of that when you after you do become a teacher, you know, especially if you're doing. If you have those students that just were not confident about using English, and then they can use English, and they're like, and it's the first thing that they've done that they've in their life that they've, it's a solid achievement for them, and you're like, well, I helped do that. I helped them move. You know, I was part of that process. you know, that's great. But a lot of the reality is there's a lot of growing pains. And going back to Kindergarten Cop, you know, who is your daddy and what does he do? You know, that's not the approach that you would take when teaching kindergarten students. And, you know, if he became a teacher, I'm sure, you know, he would like realize, oh, yeah, that's probably not the best way to start going about teaching these kindergarteners by interrogating them and shouting at them, you're not a princess.
But, you know, oh my God. It is, you're right though, it's so funny.
Pains. I don't think literally people talk about that enough with being a teacher. You kind of, oh, you're a teacher. Just because you've got the job of a teacher doesn't mean that you are a teacher.
Yeah.
You're going to make so many mistakes. And I think a lot of the reasons why teachers drop out is because they don't want to go through that growing pain of getting the experience and making the mistakes. There was a study, I can't remember what it was from, what I saw it from. I think it was a documentary. The person was talking, it was in New York State, the schools, and they were saying most teachers drop out before they're 2 years in. And,
right.
And they were saying how that's really sad because teachers only become, they said that they found the teachers only to become particularly effective after the 2 years.
That's interesting. Yeah. Something you said there that tweaked something as well. And I can't remember what it was now. It went back to something else you were saying. I'm just rambling, basically.
But yeah, I think that's when the reality is there's a lot of prep, there's a lot of grind, there's a lot of mistakes, and there's so much you're going through. It kind of equate it to like learning to drive a car. It's just you're failing, you get so frustrated, and you have everything in your mind of how you want it to be, and you just don't have the skills. Your body's not working properly. Your mind, the stuff that
I think it's worse than that though, because I think there's quite a bit of potential humiliation and embarrassment, and I think like what you're saying is, you know, people basically go through a bit of that. Like I did the first time I taught kids, you know, and it was really quite a humiliating experience. You know, because I was, you know, I was kind of big and young at the time, you know, and I was like Arnie, you know, in Kindergarten Cop. I was like, stop doing that, right? You know, like kind of bawling at them a bit.
Yeah.
That's not, you know, that's like you just used all your power without having any of it, you know, and it's all gone once that starts. You know, they know that they're the kings of the castle. You know, there's that, and it was really negative for me, and it did put me off teaching, going back to kids for a long time. And I think that's the other point I would make about it, because you were talking about teachers dropping out. It's not just about dropping out, it's that it would, you know, teachers who've had these negative experiences, they're more inclined to stay in their safe zone, like, oh, I just do business classes with adults, right? Or, oh, I, you know, and I've met some people who say, I only do kids, you know, oh, I just do kids and just the lower levels. I don't want to do the higher levels where they ask questions about grammar and stuff that I don't, because they've just had one or two bad experiences of someone asking them a grammar question they don't know the answer to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they didn't use an appropriate strategy for dealing with that situation, of which there are many, because teachers are not walking dictionaries and walking grammar reference books. You know, we can't be expected to know everything every time. I just today, when I put up that video on my channel of me teaching an online class, I don't know if I've mentioned that to you, but anyway, I put that up, and
Check it out.
Professor Rich. Well, we'll do some like selling of our appropriate channels at the end there, but youtube.com/professorrich, and so I ballsed up an explanation of fish, because she said to me, is fish uncountable? And my instant response was, oh yeah, fish is uncountable except in the situation that you're talking about different species of fish, and we can start saying fishes. And it's actually wrong fish is uncountable when you're talking about food only. When you talk about the animal, it's countable, but it has an irregular plural form, as in the singular fish, the plural is still fish. One fish, two fish, three fish. I have three fish in my tank, right?
Yeah.
And I twigged like pretty much as soon as I'd uploaded the video, to be honest. I watched it and I was like, oh, bah. So, you know, and it's like, well, I've been teaching for almost 12 years now. And, you know, that happened. Not only did I make that mistake, it was in a recorded class that I've now uploaded onto my YouTube channel, mm-hmm. which now has a disclaimer about the explanation that I give about the plurality of the word fish. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the end of the day, we're not Google, you know, we're not yeah. robots. We,
what do you mean and you don't know how to spell supercalifragilisticexpialidocious? Are you an English teacher?
Yeah, it's perfectly reasonable to A, say, interesting question. I tell you what, I'll just check into that a bit and then we'll look at that at the start of next class. Or, you know, even to have a go with an explanation that you're quite confident about, which is what I did, mm-hmm. and then balls it up a little bit and the next class be like, yo, you know, when I said that thing about fish, there's one other thing I want to tell you about it.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's hugely important in that, and when you get more experience, you realize you can make it smooth. So if someone's that's like, right. Let me get back to you on that, you can just, when they say that, you'd be like, well, that's a really interesting question, and then give like preamble while you're kind of thinking about it. Yeah.
Very much so. Know,
that's it's a skill that you learn because you're kind of not yeah. wanting to go off track, so you're kind of trying to be smooth or
true, and you always want to avoid that situation, which still happens to all of us, where someone asks you a question, you go, oh, da 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 da, okay, and there's just this silence in the classroom while the teacher looks at an empty board with their pen. You know, you just like, at what point do I turn around and go, let's come back to this? And everyone's like, teacher doesn't know.
I don't think people understand that kind of pressure as well.
Yeah, that's the thing, like, isn't it?
Okay, so imagine writer's block, but everyone's expecting and watching you to write.
But you speak English, don't you?
Well, we're going to come. Don't worry about that. We're going to come to that later, or we're going to circle back round to that. I like that. Circle back round and do the little this. And yeah. then they start looking at this.
Like, yeah, 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 yeah.
You're still sleeping.
And you're just like, right, everybody up, board rush, team A, team B. Turn on some loud music. Da, 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 da.
The question was, describe how you put together a lesson and how you teach it. So, as you probably kind of gathered from my experience and me repeating how much I love PPP, is I put together stuff with a PPP mindset framework. And it doesn't mean that I'm sticking to it, you know, to the letter, but just that idea of I've got to bring in this new language at some point. We need to do some sort of practice with the new language where I can watch over them a little bit, and then there you go, do it as whatever you can. But it, for me, it always starts with the language point. It starts, you know, what is the goal? Just, you know, like Celta, what is the thing that you want them to learn by the end of the class? But yep. also what I'm considering is when I put it together, I'm mining what they've previously learned. So, you know, I'm thinking, okay, so this is what I've got now. We're talking about animals. What have we learned previously? We've learned what? So we've got some adjectives, some colors. Can I use any of that vocabulary at the beginning of the class to kind of get them to talk about the animal? You know, how can I build? Basically, that's me when I'm trying to do my lessons. Is I'm kind of thinking of like Tetris, like how am I building And how can I put this language point and connect it in so many ways that I possibly can to the language that they already have to better learn that? And, you know, how I teach that is, you know, with the PPP, I do, and that how I teach it is going to be really dependent on whatever class I'm teaching, kids or adults or, you know, IELTS or general ESL, but it's always going to be with a focus on engagement and energy.
Yep, that's interesting that you say you focus on engagement, because you know, being that you didn't kind of run through the more you know, that the certificate side of things with the diploma and everything, you probably wouldn't know that. Have you heard of something called ESA, Engage, Study, Activate?
Yeah, that's...
Oh, you have heard that, okay.
Yeah, I see that PPP as being almost one in the same.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
They are, totally, yeah. So, no, but I think Jeremy Harmer, who, you know, came up with that, I think he kind of admits that. He just thinks that it's a better way of thinking of PPP.
Yeah,
you know,
I can see that, definitely.
Mm.
Yeah. It's just that it's still a three-part process, but I would definitely say it's better labels, because I guess when you get... That's one of the things that I think people turn off about PPP is this whole idea that this, you know, this is a pen and this is a banana and, you know, like... You're like, it's just you're lecturing them, and it's not, that's not always the case. It's always just kind of,
yeah. Well, I mean, if you just literally take the words presentation, practice, production, it could easily just be like you throw on the board, you know, I have been to France, right? And you go, right, there's your presentation. Then you practice, you go, like, right, give them a load of sentences that are kind of look like the present perfect but have a few mistakes in there. I has been to France or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then your production's a couple of questions, you know, about it or whatever, and they have to go and ask other students. But obviously that would be rubbish, you know, that would be really a threadbare, you know, PPP class. But going from those words, presentation, practice, production, you would have ticked the ideas, right? You would have actually done that. Whereas with Engage, Study, Activate, you know, you've got some things which are a bit harder to qualify there. I mean, engage, it's like, have you engaged the students?
Yeah.
Now, I guess it's a bit more, you know, learner-centric rather than rationally, have I presented something to someone? It's, you know, are the students engaged with what I'm doing? Mm-hmm. Are they studying the language point? Yeah, so like you say, it's probably a better name for it.
It almost is, whereas presentation feels like it is too narrow, engage could be too wide, because that could be a teacher coming in going, telling jokes and singing songs, and like, well, all right, it's engaging them, they're paying attention, but it's...
What's the point?
Establishing a language point.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah. But that whole idea of just three parts, however you want to put it, has always worked for me, and it's just kind of the way that I think about a class and a lesson going forward.
It's solid.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it is pretty much the same for me. But I do like to mix it up, and there's definitely a whole range of different things that I like to dip into. One of them is dialogic storytelling with Jamie Keddy style, but I'll save that for next week.
Ooh.
But what I will talk about is I'll talk a little bit about TBL.
Yeah.
Just because it's kind of on my mind, and I can't help but respond to the whole PPP thing. So even though I love the majority of my lessons are PPP, no doubt about it, and you know, people can slag it off all they want, but at the end of the day, you know, a good beer is a good beer. You don't have to pay 20 quid for a bottle of fancy wine, or whatever, you know. I don't know what I'm talking about, something like that. But yeah, the point is, PPP has a special place in my heart. But yeah, TBL. Have you done any TBL? And do you know, when I say task-based learning, what do you think of? Do you have any ideas about that?
So when I think of task-based learning, it's the focus is not so much learning the language. From my understanding, it's more that there's there's a task to be accomplished, and to, in order to accomplish that language, there's you know, English that you've got to learn to go along with that. And for example, there was an activity that I would do where they had to make like a Lego structure, but it was divided. So one student had the Lego, and the other, and then there was a blinder, and the other students had like the instructions, and they had to tell the person how to kind of construct this Lego structure without actually seeing it. So is that kind of what we're talking about here?
I mean, that would be kind of a starting point. It has a more specific framework than that.
Okay.
But that's the starting point. And even then, TBL has been sort of changed and adapted and watered down a bit, actually, a lot. Because people steer away a bit from the pure form, but I actually really like the pure form. I know there are problems with it, and I'll mention them as I kind of go. But so the pure form of TBL is something like this. First, you get the students to perform some sort of task. Now, that could be like you're saying, and by the way, this is the start of the lesson, right? So there's no, it's none of this, like, I'm going to present you with some language and here's a useful language. Forget all that. Mm-hmm. You give them a task and you go, right, do this. You can only talk in English, go, kind of thing. Or please, you know, you have your classroom rules, talk in English, and off you go. So, and the task could be, like you say, it could be building something together. It doesn't have to be so practical. Obviously, those kind of tasks are very nice, but, you know, one that I really like, that I kind of... Yeah, exactly. That's it. You know, you're stuck on a desert island. What would you take? Or, you know, you have to throw a celebrity out of a balloon. Who's it going to be or whatever? Yeah. There's one I really like from an old Cutting Edge book, which is they give you a map. And, you know, it's a very free-flowing map with a couple of things on there. And there's some notes on the back about how the guards move around and stuff. And you have to rob a museum. So you talk together about your plan for robbing the museum. And obviously, you know, there's no rules really, so you could sort of say anything. You know, I'm going to get a bazooka and blast a hole in the wall. But at the end of the day, they have to use certain, you know, they have to communicate to do it. So you let them off with that. On they go. They do their task. They have a go. They maybe struggled. In fact, you kind of want them to struggle a little bit, because that's the whole point in a way. So they struggle. And then what comes next? So next, you do a listening, where they listen to a pair of natives, a group of natives, or a native, shall we say, which might be you as the teacher, doing the task. And the way I normally do this is I record it. So I record me and another teacher, or me doing the task. And I don't think about it too much. I just do it naturally, right? And that becomes the language point, because what language am I using, or a native using, that they don't use, right? And then you have an activity after that listening, which facilitates the noticing of the language that you use that they don't. And then they do the task again, but you put a different twist on it. Like with the robbing a museum one, use a different map of a museum, or this time you rob a bank and it's a different map, right? So it's not boring. They're doing but they're doing basically the same task, but this time you've enabled them with this new language. And not only that, but there's this thing of noticing the gap, which is they were struggling when they did that task the first time, right? Because they were trying to use, I mean, theoretically, they were trying to use language that they didn't have. And then when they listened to, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Native doing it, then they realize, oh, look, that's how people who, you know, who know English pretty well do the task. So I'll use those language structures to enable me to do it. That's the theory of it, right? I like it a lot. I think it works very well. It's not without its challenges, no doubt. And to be honest, the idea of it being that pure, I mean, when you and the other teacher are recording yourself, you know, you're kind of grading your language a bit and stuff. You know, it's not totally authentic. And you could do it even purer than that and make it ultra authentic. But you know, people have a lot of problem with that these days as well, don't they, Neil, to be honest? Like, just the idea of saying the word native, I feel a bit odd when I'm saying it, because what does it mean? It's all, you know, and it all gets a bit philosophical. But, you know, I still think it's a useful model. I would hope that you know, me and another English teacher have a better command of the English language than our students, and therefore are a useful model for them. And therefore,
well, when I think native as well nowadays, it's, I don't mean the language. I think that's how we speak. That's how we think. Sorry, or you know, so we talk about language like it's somehow separate from ourselves, but when we are talking to ourselves, when we are thinking, we are, it's the structure in which we process our world in many ways. So when you're native, when you're talking about a native English speaker, it's just, you know, that is how the world is in their head. Mm-hmm. It's all English.
Okay.
So
yeah, this is, you know, I see the point you're making. Because I've studied a bit of applied linguistics, and only because of that, I know that that can get very kind of dicey and controversial as well. Oh, you know, we get into all kinds, right? We have to start talking about Noam Chomsky and all kinds of stuff if we go there. academically, anyway. Although, you know, your point's perfectly valid. And honestly, I think people make too much of it. I'm perfectly happy to accept the idea of native language speakers as a useful model, and maybe that idea is getting a bit outdated. Doesn't matter to me, because TBL, as far as I'm concerned, is really cool, and I love it. And like I say, it can be as easy, and I did this on my diploma, the TBL lesson I did on my diploma, which, by the way, my diploma tutor, I don't want to get her name wrong now, Nicola, can't remember her surname. She was wonderful. But anyway, my diploma tutor, she forced me to. She said, for your next class, you have to do TBL. And I was like, what? Never done that. And she sort of told me about TBL and said, go with this. And, you know, and that really got me into it. And when I did it, I did the native recording of me just on my smartphone. I just recorded myself audio on my smartphone in another classroom. Mm-hmm. And then threw that onto the technology they had, and did it like that, and it worked amazing, you know. And ever since then, I've been a big fan of TBL. Mm-hmm. However, I believe it takes more preparation than a PPP, which is why the majority of my classes are still PPP, because if I'm going to prep a TBL, I do think it's, you know, I am going to need extra time. And that's considering that you don't mess it up. You know, maybe you do the recording, listen to it, and think, oh, it's not going to work. Or maybe you even try out the lesson and the students just don't know, you know, it has its own problems. Like, for example, the students do the task and they use all the language that you've designed the lesson around. And suddenly you're like, well, am I teaching them now? Because they're going to listen to my recording. And they've already used all of the target language. So, you know.
You kind of need to be using it with students that you've already kind of got a good idea of if they know the language or not.
The same problem that you'd have with PPP, right? Because maybe with PPP you say, like, I'm going to go in, they're A2, so I'm going to go in and teach them, you know, past simple versus past continuous. And then you go in and they just breeze through all the activities, and then you say, like, look, they know it. My lesson succeeded. Yeah, but they already knew it. So your lesson did nothing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Not a victory at all. I will definitely look into doing more like that. I feel like I've mentioned the desert island. With conversation classes, I've done stuff like that.
Yeah.
But probably I can't think of an instance where I've done and notice the gap.
That is a critical stage, definitely, because really the big success you can have with TBL is that you don't have to push them too much for them to notice it, because really what you're trying to get them to do is for them to come to an autonomous realization that there's a tool that can help them that's there that they can now hear when they're listening to it, right? And they go, oh, cool, right? And you're training that skill of being
It reminds me of the discovery method.
You know? Yeah.
So they are discovering, they are noticing something, but it's not that they've naturally come to that. It's kind of fabricated because you're like, well, yeah, this is what you were saying. This is what this is.
Yeah, you mean inductive.
The same.
Inductive teaching,
why
right?
Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you're totally right. You're totally right, Neil. I mean, it is synthetic in a way. The idea that there's, I mean, but someone out there.
I like it because the more, the when you explain it, the more that you can get a student to work stuff out themselves, the better, because that's what sticks with them. Because you've not just taught that language point, you've also taught them a tool of, you know, critical thinking as well.
Yeah. Well, that's the selling point of inductive language teaching, isn't it? It's good that you can explain that well. I'll tell you what, because I used to have a big issue with this because I don't know if you had this experience, but I certainly had the experience early on in Spain that deductive grammar teaching worked very well, and I think it was probably because that's what they were so used to in the school system, you know, but it worked very well. You know, like, you don't do any of this, throw up a text and get them to notice the grammar structures. No. Tell them present perfect. We use it for this. This is how you form it. This is what you do. This is what I'm talking about now is deductive grammar teaching, which is very out of favor with the ELT crowd. Right? But it used to work really well because they just, it's what they expected and they loved it, you know. And they were like, oh, the present perfect is for this, and this, right? Got it. I've got the rules in my head. Right, and then you give them the exercises and off they go. And I used to have a big problem because I used to ask a lot of people who were more experienced than me, you know, why do we love inductive grammar teaching so much? Why are all the books inductive? Why do they always push inductive? You know, and inductive is the method that you're talking about, which is discovery, right? And it took me a long time to find someone who could explain it. And even on my diploma, when I was sold on deductive to some extent, but I didn't know why, right? And even then, you know, and it was partially an online course. We had some forums and I asked some of the tutors on there. And even then, you know, they were kind of brushing it off, you know, and I was kind of like, I'm getting to this level and they're brushing it off. I'm starting to lose faith in this. And I finally found one of them. It was one of the teachers at the same center, and she was absolutely bang on. In fact, she was my personal tutor for my project. I suppose I can name her because I'm complex. I think her name was Emma Mead. She was a brilliant personal tutor. And I think I asked her because I just wasn't getting particularly good answers on the forum. So I specifically, she was supposed to be my project tutor, but I just threw it into a question thing about, you know, why do we sort of prefer inductive teaching? And she explained it, you know, like you said, it's this something that it sticks in your head. The way that she put it is it automatically ticks a lot of the boxes required for like sustainable learning. So the idea that, you know, you have to investigate. Personalization happens kind of automatically because you're involved in the process of teaching yourself, which means that you're going to have a more of an emotional reaction to it, yeah, as you were talking about before with emotional memory, right? So, you know, if someone's just banging something on a whiteboard and going, this is the present perfect, you can switch off, you can make it external. It doesn't have to be personalized. But if someone gives you a text, someone gives you some clues and says, right, work this out, then you have that personal emotional investment, which helps it, as you say, it facilitates it sticking in your head, basically, doesn't it? It makes it stick in your head more. So amazing that you nailed that, because that's exactly basically what she explained to me that finally made me go, oh, okay, I can accept it now. I don't have to keep having these doubts about why are we teaching inductively all the time.
It's a key point, and I don't think it just stays with learning the language, but it also, for me, goes with classroom management as well. For example, the basic classroom management techniques, when we're talking about teaching kids, would be you want them to behave good. Oh, we're going to give them candy. You want them to not do bad things. You give them a punishment. It's all external. You know, we're wanting to move away from externalities to something more internal. So,
yep.
You know, the end goal would be a better activity to control classroom management, to see how they are, to get them to behave better, for them to see sort of the benefits of what they're doing. So, you know, yep. If you keep their essays from the beginning of the term and show them at the end of the term how much improvement they've made, then it starts to become less external to more into. I'm not explaining it very well whatsoever, but the more.
No. Yeah, I think it's pretty. I think it is clear what you're saying, Neil. The trainer, what do you call him? The head trainer at the British Council in Vietnam, who was Lily Kempman. Again, glad to call her out because she's fantastic. In fact, probably the most intelligent. See, I can get into trouble here, can't I? Because I say like she's the most intelligent something, and then other people who've been in that position where I've worked in the past suddenly get very offended, even though I respect them a lot. Let's just say she's brilliant at what she does, and she used to call it Pavlovian motivation, what you're talking about, right? Which goes back to the whole Pavlov dog thing, right? Which is like you ring the bell every time the dog eats, and then eventually you ring the bell and the dog salivates. It's that idea that, you know, yeah, give them those lovely cheeky rewards, you know, and it even gets to the point, because she was quite extreme on this position, more extreme than I am certainly, but she was of the opinion that, you know, you shouldn't necessarily need, and she probably still is of this opinion, but I don't want to speak for her, that you don't necessarily need scoreboards and kids' names on the board and all that stuff. That's still Pavlovian motivation, right?
Yeah. I mean, in the end, you're wanting them to move away from that. I mean, it's good to begin with, and it's good to get them to establish that once they see, you know, what you're doing is for their benefit, and they see the improvements, they see how it's changing them, and it's you're doing it with the best in mind for them. You know, the thing that they get from your class is they get to become not a better person. they get to achieve, and that internal feeling of achievement of doing something that you didn't think you could do. He's going to trump everything else. So I'm getting off track. But yeah. Moving away from that.
I don't know if you are. I don't know if you are getting off track. I think it's perfectly valid to talk about reward systems with when you talk about teaching methods. I think we maybe you're a little bit more in line with Lily, as I was talking about there. Whereas I am personally, I pull a bit more towards so-called, you know, Pavlovian motivation. I'm comfortable with that. I do agree that the ultimate is, you know, the students taking their own self-evaluation. I think that's a more realistic goal with older students and adults. I think to some extent with kids, it's almost, and especially certain kids, you know, I think it's almost unavoidable that they are going to derive their value, their motivation from what circumstance you can provide for them, you know. And if you are, you know, like if they are, you know, they think they're the monkey of the class, or they think they're the troublesome kid in the class, you know, and you're dealing with like 9-year-olds. Yeah. It'd be great to, you know, make those kids valuable members of society who derive value from their self-improvement. But let's be realistic, you know, at the end of the day, they're just going to love to see their name moving up that scoreboard. Or, you know, something that I'll also talk about in a future time, but one of the guys at BC Hanoi, he had a you know, this idea of loot boxes in video games, which is part of the reward of a loot box is you don't know what's in it, and then something happens, right? So he came up with this dice system where he has a leaderboard, but when you do something good, you don't just get points, you get a dice, right? Or you get a couple of dice. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, like, you've done something good, great, you've got a dice. Then not only do you get the points, you get the excitement of, am I going to get six or am I going to get one? And kids love that. I mean, that guy, right, there, and I'll name him as well, it's Kevin, right, he's phenomenal. That, you know, his primary classes, right, he walks into the room.
Yeah.
Teacher's in the room because the table that's ready first when he walks into the room mm-hmm. gets the dice roll, yeah. You know, and that's it. And they're playing the game, you know.
Yeah.
And it's Pavlovian all the way, but his behavioral management based on that Pavlovian system works incredibly well. So, yeah, I agree. Ultimately, it'd be fantastic if everyone, mm-hmm. you know, has all this self-worth and everything. But I think it's a bit idealistic as well. I think there are room for other systems.
It's something that I strive for, and I, especially with the kids, because I feel like if you can leave them with that, okay, so here's the biggest point. I'm going to finish with this, with the biggest point. I only have, depending on the type of student, I only have an hour with them in whatever class it is. And I might not even get personal attention with them. So if I can give them tools to, you know, go out and kind of learn by themselves, that's fantastic. That's what I'm kind of aiming for. The thing that I think's a bit more realistic that I can do is that I can engage with them and get them to love English and get them to love the process of learning it. That is, when I do a lesson plan, I have my language point, but in a meta and a more micro way, I'm just trying to get them to enjoy English and love it. Because if they love it, then they're going to do it outside of class. And that's where they're going to do the majority of learning. Because I've got an hour, but if I can instill them in them that it's not too big, you can do it, you look, you've been making these little progress, you know, that's, it's going to trump everything. It's going to trump any behavioral management, any system that I come up with, anything that I teach them, because...
Yeah, you're right. No, even to the extent, I mean, it'll trump you as being a good or bad teacher even. Yep. I mean, at the end of the day, if you can do what you're saying, instill, you know, that positivity about English learning, sustainable practice improvement, maybe they have you for one day and somehow it broke that in them. And then for the rest of their life, they have the worst teacher in the world. They'll still get better. It won't matter anymore because, as you say, the majority of work is done outside class. So they can then have teachers who are just writing stuff on the board, pronoun plus modal verb plus infinitive. They might be bored to hell in the lesson, but they'll still go home and they'll go pronoun plus infinitive plus whatever. Okay, I'll now combine that with the fun stuff that I've kind of got into because of the class I had with teaching Neil. And then it'll become and as you say, it's
the way. If you want to be, we're trying to be the most effective teacher possible. And if you think about it, you can only be as effective as you are in the class for learning the language. So if you focus on learning the language, just learning the language, then that's all they're going to learn. But if you can go in with that big idea of, I'm going to get them to love English. I'm going to get them to feel like they can make inroads with it outside of this class. Then you're giving them so much more than just, you know, here's how the present perfect works.
I like that a lot, Neil. The big idea of getting them to love English. Absolutely. I think that's cool. Totally.
I'm going to have to leave and finish up on this because I've got an engagement. I've got a small child that I have to go take care of.
I just make a quick comment on that point just before we completely wrap up. It's one of the metaphors that stuck in my head, and it's something that I've been using a lot. And it relates entirely to what you were saying then about the effort. I've started to say that the work that we do in class is me putting petrol in your engine. That's all it is. And then how far you go, well, that's up to you driving the car outside of class. Ooh, because we're not driving the car in class, right? You drive the car. Like you say, the work is done, the distance is traveled outside of class, because work is done in class.
Yeah.
But the work that's done in class isn't necessarily you getting very far. It's just giving you the potential, the fuel. Yeah,
exactly. I think that's a really good metaphor. And I don't think many students consider that when they start to learn anything. They think, oh, I'm going to learn it all in class. And it's not the case.
Yeah.
That's just the starting point. You've got to the start line.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I've got a video on it. www.youtube.com/ProfessorRich.
Yeah, and if you want to see any more of myself and my wife and all our stuff, we've got www.teamteacherchina.com. But most of our videos are up on YouTube as Team Teacher China. I thought that was a great interview, and I'm looking forward to next week where we get to put the spotlight onto Professor Rich and get into his background.